This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with our little cohort that likes to join us live as opposed to listening at their convenience on the podcast, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. And we'll be there during the course of the show to monitor any comments you may have about the progress of the show. And if there are any questions you think might add to the conversation, you can go ahead and put them in there. We would be glad to keep an ear out for them, or at least an eye out for them, and fold it into the conversation as it goes forward. And as always, if you want to make sure and catch every Midrats, you can go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, whatever podcast aggregator you have, and subscribe. And that way, it'll be waiting for you at your convenience to listen to whenever you get a chance. Now let's roll on into today's show. And it goes without saying, and we've covered it a couple times here over the last few months, that COVID-19 has altered the global landscape. And we're still trying to figure out how that is working, not just in your local neighborhood, but inside the U.S. and also how we relate with the rest of the world. International relations is continuing to be changed. I think warped is too strong of a word, but everybody's trying to feel their way through it. And when you look at how the U.S. is responding, you've got to keep an eye on our relationship with our largest trading partner and the world's largest nation. So I think India is maybe has her by a baby too any day now, and that, of course, is China. And one thing we're going to do today is we're going to look at how the rising of China is being impacted by COVID-19, what hasn't changed and what has modified as both China and the rest of the world adjust how they look at each other through the throes of this pandemic. And our guest today to discuss that and all sorts of related issues, whether it has to do with technology, human rights, bilateral, multilateral relations, Hong Kong, is going to be Dean Cheng. Dean is the Senior Research Fellow at the Asian Studies Center at the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Dean, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you for having me.
Really, really happy to have you on board. And I wanted, time travel is always fun, but I thought to kick off the show because it's really easy and kind of exciting to go into the minutia of the play-by-play response to COVID-19, which dominates the news. But I think there are some essential, almost unmoving, larger issues going on with China that people shouldn't lose an eye on, or at least look for how that has changed what we thought a few months ago. And frozen in amber from the end of the previous era, back at the end of January, before everything flopped over in late February, early March, you were over at the at a panel at the U.S. Embassy in Austria, and there was an interesting focus of the conversation that I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about how y'all worked around this topic and how you think this idea may have pulled itself through to the present day as everybody's used to COVID. And that was the discussion of China's view that national power no longer comes with industry, but the ability to generate and exploit information. So I thought we'd back up a few months back in January and kind of flesh out that idea and what people should keep in mind.
Sure. It's amazing to think that the end of January really does seem like almost a century ago. COVID-19 is probably going to be a lot like World War I in the sense of people talked about pre-war and they understood exactly which war you were talking about. And I think we'll probably be talking about pre and post-COVID. But one of the things that marked Chinese thinking since the late 1990s and is actually influencing their behavior now in the middle of COVID and will be afterwards is this idea that the world has shifted the currency of power. The Chinese Communist Party, which rules China, is still a communist party, by which we don't mean from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. That isn't the case in China at all these days. This is a country that has, at least before the economic crises of the moment, hundreds of billionaires, thousands of millionaires, and a third of the country lived on, we think, about $3 a day. So this is not equality. But it is a Marxist-Leninist party, which meant that, among other things, it looks at the world with the view that the nature of economics influences politics, influences power, influences relationships. And so in this context, the rise of ICT, information and communications technologies, the internet, supercomputing, artificial intelligence, all of these things, has shifted us from the industrial age, where power was measured by the ability to make stuff, tons of merchant shipping, tons of bauxite smelted to make aluminum, tons of steel produced, is now being not completely replaced, because those things still matter, but are being edged out by information, the ability to generate it, the ability to exploit it, the ability to analyze it better, more rapidly, more accurately than other people, the ability to move it around. And so in this, so the industrial age was up through the late 1980s, early 1990s. Today we live in the information age. And so countries are increasingly going to measure their power by how much information they can generate, by how much information they can analyze. Now, information here isn't just cyber. That's one other thing that, for your listeners to keep in mind. When the Chinese are talking about information, they mean literally all of it. They mean movies. They mean culture. They mean perceptions. And so one of the things that we are seeing with COVID-19 is the Chinese trying to shape how the world thinks about this disease and China's role with that disease. And at the end of the day, that is also an aspect of information. And so the Chinese are engaging in political warfare, which is in some ways the hardest form of soft power, the weaponization, if you will, of information at the strategic level, and are trying to influence how individuals, leaders, entire nations look at China, look at other countries, including the United States, and in an ideal world from China's perspective, think of China as both the good guy, the smart guy, and the future partner in this information age.
That raises a whole bunch of issues, but I really like the phrase hardest form of soft power. By the way, one of the things that I find interesting, the way China has approached the information that has come out about COVID-19, is their effort to seize the message, control the message, and use all the tools they have to co-opt, or they've already co-opted a bunch of folks, and the way that message is going out. So we saw initially a lot of people referring to COVID-19 as the Wuhan or the Chinese virus, and then that became totally discouraged. Can you kind of talk about the power that China has to alter, force us to other people to alter their language and the way they look at these things?
The Chinese understand that how they are perceived, whether it is as a source of high-tech goods, that are reliable or low-tech goods that are unreliable is going to influence chances for partnerships, chances for hooking up their industry to other countries, their role in supply chains, etc. So the funny thing is that, you know, the Chinese have handled the actual information about COVID-19 incredibly badly. They clamped down on their own internal reporting system. They actually had a pandemic response mechanism in place. They short-circuited it. We're still not sure exactly why. They now seem to have admitted that they destroyed samples. They clearly pressured the WHO not to announce a health emergency, which would have brought about a travel ban. But with all of that, they are very good at also identifying our own weaknesses. The Chinese have protested strongly whenever anyone has referred to it as the Wuhan flu. I personally like Wu flu. It rhymes. Or Chinese coronavirus, Chinese virus. But they are also riding a wave of our own PC-ness. A lot of people were uncomfortable making reference to a national source of origin. The press itself was using Wuhan flu, Wuhan coronavirus in the early days and suddenly pulled a 180. And I think that unfortunately some of that has to do with domestic politics. Simply who is using that phrase and who isn't. But for the Chinese, they are working incredibly hard to shape the global narrative. China is not the source of the disease. It certainly didn't come from wet markets or from any labs in China, because that would imply that China was unsafe and China was unsophisticated. China's response has been pretty much perfect. Whether it's domestic, which is why they keep claiming that there's only about 80,000 cases, 4,000 deaths, and that it has been generous in its aid to foreign countries with personal protective equipment. And moving forward, China should be the partner you want to work with for a vaccine and for post-COVID supply chains.
That desire to control the messaging and the direction. I know early on in the pandemic, the Chinese expelled a whole cadre of some of the leading Western journalists, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, and so forth. And those entities have not really returned. And how much of that was them just the baseline instinct of get those people out of here so they don't report? And how much was that an attempt on intimidation? And how much have we seen of Chinese simply trying to, what they can't win with facts, trying to shape through intimidation?
I like the phrase, embrace the power of and. I don't think that this is an either-or situation. I think that, in fact, there were probably three separate pieces involved in that decision. The first, which I think was probably actually quite important, was the American decision in the weeks leading up to the Chinese expulsion that Chinese state media, Xinhua, the Chinese state news agency, People's Daily, CGTN, which stands for China Global Television Network, all of these, which are state-run media in China, had to register with the United States as foreign agents. And the Chinese thought this was outrageous. And if we are going to do that, their justification for the expulsion was, well, New York Times and Washington Post are going to have to register as foreign agents, and by the way, we're going to restrict the number of reporters you allow. The Chinese understanding of a free press remains somewhat problematic. The second part, I think, was to limit foreign journalistic access, especially as COVID-19 ramped up. The Chinese have never allowed that many journalists in, certainly not people with journalist visas. A lot of journalists, Western journalists, have operated on a tourist visa, and the danger there is if you are caught doing something you're not supposed to, like interviewing people or writing exposés, they can suspend your tourist visa, you're in violation, and boot you out of the country without any paperwork whatsoever. Just show up and boot you out, and that's happened over the years. The intimidation factor is absolutely also part of this, because they've picked American news agencies and news entities, but the message is very clear, whether it's to Deutsche Welle or to France 24 or to the BBC, certainly to African journalists and South American journalists, you exist in China at our sufferance. Don't make us angry. Don't pursue stories you shouldn't. And you'll notice that there's been relatively limited digging, therefore, into how many cases of COVID have actually occurred in China. Or put differently, is it really credible that in a country four times the size of the United States, with, you know, a disease that is incredibly virulent, that you only had 80,000 cases and the last official cases were sometime in March? And if it's not credible, why haven't other reporters, not necessarily from the New York Times or Washington Post, but from El Diario or Middle Eastern newspapers, done any digging on this? And I think that part of this was, look what happened to the Americans.
Well, they haven't just gone after the news media, though. Every time an Australian politician comments on China's problems with COVID-19 or an American politician, the Chinese have come out strong saying, we're going to make you suffer as a result of what you're saying. I mean, this is part of what you described in a piece as the public information warfare. And, you know, part of this is just, we're going to punish you as psychological. And I have a lot of questions about the legality of all that, but this is part of their a warfare strategy that they've adopted. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. It is part of a warfare strategy. And here, one, the Chinese term for it itself, Yulun Zan. Zan is the character for conflict or war. This is not internal struggle. This is not competition. This is warfare. This is, now it doesn't have to be kinetic. The other thing is that when the Chinese talk about public opinion warfare, the fascinating aspect here is that they talk about it and they say, you have to think about this as warfare. And what did we mean by that? Think musmus. Think principles of war, mass, security, surprise, that there has to be a plan. You orchestrate public opinion warfare. It's not just a PAO somewhere making a statement, oh, well, we're engaging in public. No, there is a consistent message. There's combined arms effects that people who are reporters in China, people who are government officials, say the foreign minister or foreign ministry spokesperson on their Twitter account, head of a Chinese state-owned enterprise, will all be pushing out the same messages to different audiences, but in a hopefully mutually reinforcing way.
Many times people and organizations will signal to you what they're worried about and what they fear simply by how quickly and how enthusiastically they react to things. It can be quite telling. And you know, Paul in the chat room, he had an interesting question that, you know, goes back to the Chinese Communist Party that wields all power. What does the Chinese Communist Party leadership fear the most? And in their response to COVID, have they given us any signals that assumptions we may have had were correct? Are any changes that we can see in what drives them from that fear point of view?
The biggest thing the Chinese leadership fears, and this was true even before COVID, but COVID has definitely exacerbated this, is the loss of power. And that is ultimately a function of internal domestic politics. It's a question of legitimacy. So Xi Jinping doesn't go to bed at night worried about the possibility of the 82nd Airborne dropping into Tiananmen Square. All due respect to the 82nd. It is worried about the problem of, okay, there is no alternative. There aren't political parties within the Chinese Communist Party. Xi Jinping has really concentrated power. There's no one else on the blame line. So if the economy falters because of COVID-19, or more importantly, because of the trade war that preceded COVID-19, if China's ability to be part of the global supply chain is called into question because of espionage and the like, Xi Jinping is at least partly responsible for this. And in China, the Chinese leadership faces a population that is willing to let the CCP stay in power so long as it delivers the goods. What are the goods? Jobs, which are in trouble because of the global economic shutdown. Food. There is a massive problem with China's pig farms, and the staple meat in China is pork, not chicken, called African swine fever, which has decimated pig herds throughout China. And to the point where there is some rationing, we think, of pork going on. So on the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, you know, if Chinese people are asking themselves, am I living better? The fact that you can't get enough pork for Chinese New Year's is going to be a real problem. On the foreign policy side, one of the fundamental things is Taiwan. Again, an issue of legitimacy. Taiwan is part of China. That is a line that the CCP has pushed since 1949. It's one of the reasons why Taiwan was excluded from talking to the World Health Organization and its subsidiary, the World Health Assembly. It's a reason why the Chinese pressured WHO to ignore whatever Taiwan might have had to say about COVID, including, hey, this is human-to-human transmissible. If nations post-COVID say, you know, China, you've been really irresponsible, and the Taiwanese have been very responsible and successful in limiting disease transmission, we think their voice should be heard. You will see an enormous ratcheting up of pressure on Taiwan. The Taiwan Straits could easily become as tense as they were in 1995-96 when the Chinese were testing missiles around the island, or worse in the 1950s.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question that kind of relates to that, which is, is China mostly interested in being a regional hegemon or in being a world power, or are those mutually exclusive?
So the Chinese are different than any other major power we have confronted as a nation before, partly because they're not European. And that is very important because they come out of a different context. If you think about European politics throughout the last 400 years, it has been marked by balance of power politics among a group of major powers: Russia, Prussia, Spain, Great Britain, France, Sweden at one point, Austria, etc. So anytime a single power rose, Napoleon, Hitler, or the Soviet Union, there would come together a coalition of countries to oppose it. That never happened in Asia. 5,000 years of history, you have no history of balance of power politics against China. You never had an alliance between the Koreans and the Khmers, between the Japanese and the Vietnamese. Instead, you had a single central power, and Zhongguo, which is often translated as Middle Kingdom, could just as easily be translated as Central Kingdom, and tributary states along the periphery who basically appeased China rather than coming together. So that's a fundamentally different worldview. That's a fundamentally different natural order of things. The other thing is that, you know, China itself, it's not clear that it wants to rule the world the way the Soviets wanted to, or the way Great Britain and the United States generally have, with military bases everywhere, where we had messianic ideologies. We wanted to spread the word of God for some, or the power of democracy and capitalism, or in the case of the Soviet Union, Soviet-style communism. It, for the Chinese, it is absolutely first priority is to secure their homeland. But that's a homeland that includes Taiwan, the South China Sea, at least one province, state of India. They've now raised the interesting point, you know, Kazakhstan's not really a country and hasn't been for very long. They want a sphere of influence across the Western Pacific littoral from Japan down to the Straits of Malacca, conveniently also the first island chain, that will look to China and defer to China. It's not that there will be Chinese troops necessarily on the streets of Seoul or Tokyo or Manila, but that these countries will defer to Chinese wishes. Again, that's a very different model of international relations and power. And then for the rest of the world, the priority, at least at the moment, seems to be much more on trade. But understanding that China wants to set industrial standards, political norms, to shape and influence these other countries, not to become colonies. They're okay with independent countries, but which defer and give tribute to Beijing.
I'm glad you mentioned the Kazakh thing that broke into my news feed last week. I had to take a double take on it because you look at a map and Kazakhstan, when you look at the square footage, and I'm just spitballing here, it's about two-thirds the size of China with only a population of 18 million. And when the Kazakhs called the Chinese ambassador, it was interesting to see in that article that had the kerfuffle. They said, well, there were a couple of Kazakh tribes that, offered fealty to the Chinese emperor. And you look at Kazakhstan on one end and the events over in the South China Sea, latest is against Malaysia. It's you're trying to figure out what's driving this, and it's probably a variety of things, somewhere between economics, trying to get that economy to continue to grow because the Chinese people like having a higher standard of living like anybody else. Whether there's a little bit of that national greatness, national ego going on, or that, you're talking about the tributary nature that they wanted to have with the nations around them. How much of this is a legitimate attempt at this is an inexact phrase, but a neo-imperial reset for China as she reassumes what she sees as her rightful place in the world. What between those three items, economics, national greatness, and ego, are that strange little neo-imperial reset, what mixture of that do you think is driving a lot of these actions in her, to use an old Soviet phrase, near abroad?
I want to start by saying that I think the neo-imperial phrase is probably not a good one. I think that the Chinese, your previous caller noted, sometimes they give away what they're thinking. And I think that how the Chinese describe their own rise is important. Xi Jinping calls this the China dream, the great revival of the Chinese people. So this is not a new country, Imperial Germany, elbowing its way onto the stage. It is the return of the great power back to its rightful place. So it's not neo-imperial. It's also not paleo-imperial. And I do think that that is a huge, huge piece of what is driving the Chinese, because it's like you will fight a lot harder to defend what is yours than to try and take something from someone else. You can mobilize the population. You can call for greater sacrifice. And that, I think, is a huge piece of what is driving this, is the perception, manipulated by the CCP, that China is simply reclaiming what has always been its own. Yeah, we were laid low for a while. That opium war thing really screwed us up. By the way, that was drugs pushed on us by the British, but we got over that, we're back, and thank you, America, for keeping the seat warm. We'll take it from here. And then, of course, the legitimacy aspect goes is very high because this is a CCP, and these all come back to CCP legitimacy. CCP legitimacy is founded on multiple pillars. One is you, the Chinese people, live better under us. You, the Chinese people, will be proud of China again because of what we are doing. You, the Chinese people, will also achieve greater things, whether in space or cyber or elsewhere, because of the efforts guided by we, the vanguard party of the that is the CCP. So I think that these all sort of twist together into this broad set of motivations. The Chinese often think holistically. And I think this is a good example of the CCP thinking holistically, because I think all of these strands feed into justification for the party staying in power, and conversely, each aids and abets the other aspects.
Does the Chinese Communist Party assume that all members of the of Greater China, if you will, are Han, or are they? Do they take into account that they have all these minorities, especially areas like Tibet, you know, the Uyghurs, whatever, I'm terrible on foreign pronunciation. Uyghurs, thank you. You know, they've got all these people who don't view themselves the same way as being Chinese as such, and some of them are being taken to account for that. You know, is this a... except by controlling those populations, is there any way that China is going to deal with these folks who may be disaffected from the Han tradition? There is such a thing?
Right. See, I think that we, the West, have too often sort of associated the Han race as somehow a weird Asian version of Aryan master race. Imagine mixing a Chinese and German accent when that's a master race. And that's just not really what's at play here. What we have sorry about that. Our dog apparently reacts to the phrase master race.
this is a dog-friendly show. It's okay.
The Han, first off, we need to recognize that the Han, insofar as in the Chinese population, are somewhere between 80 and 90% of the population. These are not the Slavs of the Soviet Union. They are overwhelmingly the population of the People's Republic of China. The Tibetans, the Manchus, everybody combined, at most comes up to about 15%. So that's one important difference. Another thing to keep in mind is that China has been viewed as a civilizational state, not a nation state. That was Lucian Pai who came up with that. And so it had other ethnicities within it that nonetheless were considered part of the Chinese civilization. Admiral Zheng He, who led the treasure fleets of the Ming Dynasty, was apparently Muslim, may have been in fact a Uyghur or proto-Uyghur, certainly was not necessarily from the central Chinese heartland. So when the Chinese talk about sort of this greater China aspect, I think they expect to see, whether you are, you know, Hui or Han or any of these other ethnicities, that you will nonetheless be proud of the fact that you are Chinese, of the Chinese civilization. Quick anecdote here. When Shenzhou 5 went up, China's first manned spacecraft, they basically wrote to the Taiwanese authorities and said, hey, we're about to send China's first spacecraft up. Is there anything you want us to take up with us? And the Taiwanese authorities basically provided a bag of seeds, which went up, came back down, and was returned to China with a little note card that basically said, this to certify these seeds went up into space on Shenzhou 5, China's first manned mission. Why would Taiwan do that? Because there is this underlying appeal. Now, if you're a Tibetan where you're weaker, you're not going to feel that warm and fuzzy feeling for the central authorities in China. You are quite likely to think of yourself as a race apart, a civilization apart. When you have 5,000 years of history, there's both a lot of truth to that and also a lot of times when you weren't. And that's the complicating factor that the Chinese government is exploiting.
Eagle One?
Oh, I thought it was my question. I'll ask another question, sure. I was going to point out that one of the reasons that Chinese might be interested in Kazakhstan is that there's 30 billion barrels of oil under there. If they're looking for a land route to an oil supply as opposed to the Strait of Malacca and that long, convoluted ship route, there might be some rational reason for them to look to the west there and try and reclaim that lost territory.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the Belt and Road Initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative, which has gone through multiple names, has also gone through multiple justifications. It started as a massive jobs program for the steel and cement industry in China. You already had built entire ghost cities, cities that had no population. What do you do next? You start exporting. You start building things outside of China. They exported jobs. A lot of these giant projects throughout the world are staffed entirely by Chinese. So not just management, but the actual workers, the people who are laying pipe, who are welding, etc., are often Chinese. And another piece of this was to, in fact, secure various hydrocarbons, food. China is a net importer of food. Kazakhstan, thanks to Khrushchev, grows food as well as has oil, raises, I believe, a whole lot of sheep, and is part of, as this plan has evolved, you have also seen the building of a massive infrastructure, roads, railways, fiber optic lines, pipelines, out of China to first Central Asia, but now extending to Europe. By the way, an interesting side note there. When you look at Chinese maps of Belt and Road Initiatives, they don't go into Russia. That infrastructure heads west and southwest into places like Azerbaijan and, in some cases, Iran and Turkey. But they don't seem to be very much focused on hooking by way of Kazakhstan into the main Russian transportation infrastructure networks. They are laying pipeline into Kazakhstan. They have invested heavily in the Kazakhstan oil industry. Insofar as they can avoid the Malacca dilemma, that choke point, the Chinese are absolutely interested in it.
I wonder how much, when you look at, you mentioned Taiwan earlier, by any measure you want to use, it's an incredibly high-functioning country, very much a Chinese cultural country in its own way. And it had a very different and successful response to COVID. And the question I have is there were, every year it seemed there was more and more, you talked about the seas, but more and more connections between the, lack of a more elegant term, mainland China and Taiwan. How much of that information control have we seen trying to keep that example, whether it's about having a vibrant democratic type of government and also the response to COVID, have we seen in that relationship between Taiwan and the mainland?
We have seen, from the strategic to the tactical level, China waging information warfare against Taiwan. So at the strategic level, in terms of political warfare, Taiwan is a four-letter word in diplomatic circles if there are Chinese authorities present. China has systematically tried to buy, literally, all of Taiwan's remaining diplomatic partners. I think it is still recognized by about 13 countries. One of the key players is Vatican City, the cope, because there's a religious piece to that, but there's also a diplomatic aspect to that. It is Taiwan's last diplomatic outpost in Europe. We have seen them pick up countries in Africa, making plays across the Central Pacific and also in Central and South America. So that's at the strategic level. Chinese authorities, Chinese officials who are sitting in key international organizations act as Chinese officials, not as international officials. So, for example, the head of the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, tried to ban Taiwanese journalists from covering open ICAO events on the grounds of, but there are Chinese journalists already present, and was referring to Xinhua, the state media of the PRC, and People's Daily. Why should these people be accredited? They're from, you know, part of China. You know, the International Telecommunications Union, which manages global frequencies and things like that, has basically tried to make sure that Taiwan is not present in their debates. And, of course, the WHO, you know, refused to even, I mean, a senior doctor being interviewed pulled his mic and walked off the set because a journalist asked about Taiwan. I mean, this gives you an idea. And that person, by the way, was a Canadian doctor, not a Chinese. You know, all the way down to Taiwan is probably the most, or certainly one of the most, hacked sites. And they get hit by, you know, the cyber equivalent of novel coronavirus all the time coming from the mainland. And so they have a very well-developed cybersecurity function trying to handle that. So China is systematically trying to isolate it and trying to cut it off. And we, the U.S., are pretty much the only country that exports arms to them. To give you an idea of how petty the Chinese are, France is under contractual obligation to upgrade their Lafayette-class frigates that they sold to Taiwan in the 1990s, and the Chinese are now protesting the provision of a bunch of decoy systems that are supposed to be provided as an upgrade, modernization for these frigates that are, you know, pushing 30 years old.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the, I want to say infiltration, but it may not be the right word, of these international organizations by Chinese officials. And the one specifically that you were just talking about, the International Telecom Union, and China's efforts to take over a big chunk of the internet, if not control it all. I mean, they can you kind of talk about that a little bit, where the Chinese are trying to take the from the ICANN and push it into their own Chinese national internet registry?
So the internet is a multi-layered entity, and if you basically look at websites, you know, you type https://, you know, and a name, right? Your podcast. That's one way to do it. But there are these, you know, multi-digit aspects. That is sort of your address on the web. How do you get an address? You can go to a company and buy that, but where did they get that from? And that's the governing authorities at the end of the day. So there is the International Corporation for the Assignment of Names and Numbers, ICANN. That is the entity that currently sort of serves as traffic cop and administrator for the internet. And underneath are a series of regional internet administrators. And all of this is not purely governmental. ICANN is built on what is termed a multi-stakeholder approach. It includes nations, but it includes corporations. It includes NGOs. It includes religious organizations. And it has included some non-state entities, such as Taiwan, which is why there are Taiwanese websites that have a suffix, .tw. China's is .cn. That was a huge point of contention, because China's argument was Taiwan should be .cn. By making it .tw, you were somehow saying that they're not part of China. And the Chinese have been at a national level, but also in terms of their officials in international organizations, such as the current head of the ITU, the biggest competitor with ICANN, have been trying to basically say, no, first off, Taiwan isn't, you know, shouldn't be independent even on the internet. It should be part of China. And second of all is ICANN, which allows groups like religious organizations to have a say in the management of the internet, also needs to go by the wayside. The International Telecommunications Union of the United Nations, which pretty much only allows nation states to have a role, should be the thing that manages the internet, including domain names, internet addresses, licensing authority, etc. ITU already manages the electromagnetic frequencies, what frequencies are assigned to GPS, what frequencies are assigned to CB radios for military use, for radars, for, you know, that's the whole spectrum use. ITU manages that. The Chinese officials who have been there and who are there view this as also, however, a way of pushing China's state interests. And as you can imagine, as frequency and bandwidth become more and more of an issue, this is a major, major fight. This is the equivalent of fighting for the seas in the 19th century. This is the highways of commerce in the 21st century, in the information age. And China intends to be the entity that manages the rules, norms, and standards for the new information lanes of communication.
You brought up a topic that when most people, it broke into their background, involved the World Health Organization. But there are other international organizations, like we just talked about, where, you know, depending upon what news cycle you run through, it appears that all of a sudden, overnight, you find that the Chinese have their hands on a lot of levers of power and are shaping these international organizations to head in directions that they haven't headed before, that just happened to be where China would like them to go. How did that happen, and what type of process is China using to enhance the influence that she's been exerting on international organizations compared to how they had been doing even in the most recent past?
So the Chinese really do think in the longer term. I mean, it sounds so cliched, but it's true. So the Chinese have been putting people into these organizations as junior level officials 10, 15, 20 years ago. These people didn't just pop in. I mean, at the very, very top, it's always been political. But the mid-level managers, like any bureaucracy, often is a matter of endurance. Are you've been there for 12 years, 15 years, you're just going to rise through the system. So part of this is a long-term Chinese effort, and it is helped by stability at the top in China. Xi Jinping has just declared, you know, that he's going to stay in charge for as long as he wants. But even before that, Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin, his two predecessors, were in place for 10 years apiece. A second part to this is a plan. This is not random. This is not, flitting from topic to topic. And, well, this year our initiative is going to be X, and we're going to pour money into that, and we're going to really make this an effort. And at the end of that year, we're going to call it the year of the UN bureaucrat, and then we'll move on to supporting arts programs in, you know, sort of Central Africa. Nope. This is a strategic objective that we are going to pour political, economic, financial resources into. We will corral friends and allies. And we have a battle plan. One of the things the Chinese try to establish control over any organization that they go into, whether it's a business joint venture or at the UN or elsewhere, is getting their people into the HR department to help run it, to help facilitate getting their people and to vet people who may not be Chinese, but to make sure that other people certainly aren't going to be pro-Taiwan. And then finally, another piece of this is the willingness to basically jawbone and coerce and bribe and influence and persuade other countries for those very top positions. The directors of these are pretty much okayed via the UN membership. So the very top directors, and these are people that the Chinese either will put their own people forward or will support certain key friendly people as part of sometimes it's horse trading. Belt and Road Initiative in this regard is a great, hey, you know, we built you a port, we built you a railroad, we are building mines. We'd really appreciate your support for the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, or WHO, or what have you. The West, as a whole, individual countries rarely have that kind of long-term thinking. But even worse is we don't coordinate among ourselves. And so you will have a very qualified Canadian and Norwegian and American competing for votes against the Chinese candidate, who may not even be Chinese, but may be somebody from, say, Syria or Pakistan. Or any place else that the Chinese know will be responsive to a Chinese lead.
Speaking of long-term projects, I noticed that a professor at Case Western was just arrested, apparently for getting information for China. And this seems to be a recurrent theme of their ability to get into our educational systems at a fairly important level where they gather information that may or may not be classified. A lot of it has been classified. A lot of it, people have been arrested as a result. And I noticed, that, to get back to COVID-19, that one of the recent complaints is that apparently China's very strongly trying to find out what information they can on the vaccine preparations that are going on for COVID-19. Is this just the nature of the way they're gathering information, as we discussed earlier?
The American and Soviet and arguably European program, intelligence programs tend to focus on particular things and try to find out more about that one item or that one project. The story goes, I don't know if it's true or not, that back in the 80s and 90s, the NSA, National Security Agency, had entire rail cars sitting at Fort Meade filled with tapes of intercepted phone conversations and like that no one had ever looked at, simply because we didn't have the manpower to go and listen and translate and then assess. If there's one thing the Chinese have, it's people. So they seem to have a very different approach, which is, the story goes, if the Chinese, if the Americans want to figure out a landing beach, they'll send satellites and maybe a drone. The Soviets would probably send a Spetsnaz team ashore by submarine and bring home samples. The Chinese would simply send 100,000 tourists and have each one bring back one grain. And that's still enough sand to then try and produce a model of what the sand would be like. What I think we are seeing with the Chinese is a giant hoovering, that giant sucking sound you hear is that of the Chinese, in a sense, gathering as much information as possible about everything. And can you analyze it all, or do you wind up with rail cars full at some Chinese, NSA equivalent? Today's computers are much more powerful, and the Chinese themselves talk about ABC, artificial intelligence, big data, and cloud computing. And the idea is to use artificial intelligence and all of this modern computing power, not to do all of the analysis, but to sort of weed through, to identify common denominators, et cetera, and then hand over a much smaller, curated, if you will, set of data to human analysts to do the final analysis and understanding of what you're looking at. So I think that the Chinese are very much, whether it's for COVID-19 or for anything else, trying to gather as much data from multiple different sources as possible. In the case of a lot of these university professors, this is exacerbated by the 1,000 Talents program, which basically says there's a whole lot of talent out there that's not Chinese, and it's for sale, whether legally for sale or not. So if we're willing to pay people, they'll probably give us that data. There was a professor at Harvard whose contract was apparently for $50,000 a month. While he was also getting money from Harvard and from the U.S. government. I don't know. It seems to me like, you know, $600,000 a year is a lot of money. Who knows? Maybe for Harvard professors, you know, it's just like, you know, a tip.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. $600,000, even in Cambridge, that'll buy a couple of cups of coffee. I would feel bad if I got through this show without going back to something that, I don't know, I have a personal weakness for lost causes and beautiful losers, but in 2019, watching what was going on in Hong Kong was both sad and inspirational at the same time. And when COVID hit, that knocked the protest back and kind of put everything on ice. And I was wondering, when you look at Hong Kong and what they're trying to preserve, is it really a lost cause there? Or is the Chinese mainland population, the CCP, are they just playing the long game of boil the frog and eventually that what makes Hong Kong unique will just fade away?
My wife and I honeymooned in Hong Kong, so Hong Kong has a very warm spot in our hearts. And it is kind of scary and sad to see what has been going on. In the midst of COVID-19, the Chinese swooped in and arrested a bunch of their the leading dissident people, leaders of the movement. One, I suspect, because they knew that the world was not paying as close attention to developments in Hong Kong because of COVID-19, but also because they were going to make very clear to Hong Kong who was in charge. Since then, there have been protests and mass arrests of the protesters. The reality is that Hong Kong is part of China. And although China is breaking the international treaty, that is the basic law, no one is holding them accountable. But at the end of the day, the Chinese also know that if worst comes to worst, they can wait it out till 2047, slowly constraining Hong Kong, and then in 2047 simply say, okay, well, time's up. That's what the treaty said. The hope had always been that China would liberalize. People who say, no, that wasn't part of the plan. Look, that was the whole idea behind the basic treaty, was who knows what China would look like 50 years from now, and it might liberalize, and it might take a page from Hong Kong with a free press and a free judiciary, etc. And the Chinese understood that. And the Chinese pretty much made clear even at the time, we're not going to let this tail wag the dog. We are not going to let this become a germ of democracy that will spread within us. It's just that these days they are way more blatant about it. When you arrest a Chinese-Swedish dual citizen from a rail car while he's sitting with Swedish diplomats, you are telling the world, we're going to make our own rules, and you'll accept them. And so far the world has.
Yeah, I know we're running close to the end of the hour, but that seems to me to be as an outside observer, China's philosophy about a lot of things, those islands in the South China Sea. We're going to get away with it because nobody is going to hold our feet to the fire, the fact, or we're going to go after the drill rig, oil rigs in the exclusive economic zones of other countries because nobody's going to do anything about it. And, you know, it's that kind of sort of bullying attitude that, you know, I'm not sure we cover enough in our media, other than to say this happened, rather than point out this is happening because they can get away with it and nobody's going to do anything about it. And then the question is, well, what do you do about it? Just like, how do we hold China accountable for the economic damage wrought by COVID-19 and their failure to tell people the truth early on that would have saved lots of lives and certainly helped not hurt our economies the way it is?
At the end of the day, you have to recognize that the Chinese are challenging the system. And that's something that I think, you know, what was it that John F. Kennedy wrote in the 1940s, while England slept? Part of it is, do you think that China is an adversary? And it is by no means a foregone conclusion in Washington, D.C., in the circles of power, you know, within the Beltway, war in our media, that China is an adversary. I won't go so far as to call it enemy, because that alone, that word is still verboten. But are they an adversary? Because there have been letters signed and you know, signed by China scholars and former diplomats and academics about how, no, they're not an enemy, and we shouldn't make them an enemy, as though what China, a 5,000-year-old civilization, thinks is going to be decided by us and not by them. You know, and, well, if we do X, then China will react badly, as though, oh, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of cyber theft and building islands and doing all this sort of stuff is, well, but they have a right to do that. I mean, that's almost the implicit aspect here. And, you know, when you invite the Chinese to one of our biggest multinational exercises multiple times, and the Chinese never invite us to any of them, and the response when you ask, why is this okay, is, well, they have nothing to teach us. Wow, arrogance. Or, well, we're intimidating them. Ah, stupidity. Arrogance and stupidity in one package. How very efficient of us. That's not a good formula for countering an adversary who knows where they want to be and are heading there. And before your callers express outrage, yes, I stole that line blatantly from Babylon 5.
Well, as our friend Claude would say, you could, the use and reference of Babylon 5 just shows good intelligence, thought, and taste. So it's a good way to end the show. And question I have for you here is, what are you working on right now? And if the listeners, Dean, want to keep track on what you're working on and read some of the stuff that you might have coming up or watch, well, nobody's doing very many panels nowadays. But anyway, if they want to track on your good work, where's a good place for them to keep an eye on?
Most of my work can be found at www.heritage.org. I've got a paper coming out, If the Gods of Editing Are Merciful, very soon, on Chinese wolf warrior diplomats. Basically, why are they being so aggressive these days? And I'm also working separately on just a chapter in a book on Chinese views of deterrence, because that very important concept means a very different thing once you cross the Pacific and go to Beijing.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to seeing that, especially about the diplomats, because, boy, they did eat their Wheaties in the morning. Really appreciate you coming on. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Look forward to the next opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks a lot, Dean. It's been a great pleasure and very enlightening.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Molly wrote on me to reply to Aristide, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the stranded.